Welcome to Mind Matters News. This is Mike Egner. I have the pleasure of having a conversation today with Bruce Gordon. Bruce is going to be a on faculty at St. Constantine College in Houston. And in the upper school, he'll be teaching logic, mathematics, and science. And in the college, he will be teaching in the philosophy department and also science in the humanities. Bruce, it is, as always, a pleasure and a privilege to have you join us. So welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here again.
We had, in our last session, discussed the weaknesses of materialism, and perhaps we can move on to dualism and the strengths and weaknesses of dualism, leading ultimately to looking at the perspective of idealism. If we were in an elevator together and I told you that I was a dualist, what would you tell me about what I get right and what I get wrong?
Well, if you told me you were a dualist, I probably wouldn't be overly exercised to try to change your mind, because I think that, you know, that's not bad. It's a whole lot better than being a materialist. However, if we were to press into the issue further, we'd have to discuss, well, what kind of dualist are you? And why do you think that that's a good way of looking at the world and a good way of understanding the relationship of the mind to the world? And really, I guess you could say there are three broad categories of dualist as well. We talk about three categories of materialist: eliminativist, reductivist, and non-reductivist. We could talk about three categories of dualists: property dualists, hylomorphic dualists of an Aristotelian sort of variety, or of a Thomistic sort of variety. So there's a subdivision in that categorization. And then, of course, a more robust kind of Cartesian or neo-Cartesian substance dualism as well. So what should we say here? What is property dualism? Property dualism basically says that there are mental properties. There's not a mental substance. There's mental properties that somehow supervene upon physical properties. So there are two distinct realms of properties, at least physical properties and mental properties. And the mental properties are, of course, not reducible to the physical properties. They have a vitality in some sense of their own. Now, the concern, one of the concerns, of course, is that this really seems to have a, just kind of a one-way relationship. The mental properties are dependent upon the physical properties, but not reducible to them. But the mental properties don't have a downward causal effect upon the physical properties. So they're epiphenomenal, and they're kind of floating free. Now, given that sort of anomalous relationship, one wonders what one can say about the nature of the mental properties, which would include things like beliefs, if they're somehow detached from the physical world, or produced by the physical world and not operative upon the physical world. It seems to lead to a kind of self-referentially incoherent position, in the sense that we have no confidence that the beliefs that just happen to be generated by the physical processes that generate them are in any way reflective of the nature of physical reality that undergirds them. And they don't seem to be influencing our actions in any way, physically speaking. So what are we left with? We're left with a situation in which we are affirming property dualism and its epiphenomenal character, but we have no reason to think that that belief is true, right? It undermines itself in a kind of fundamental way. So, I mean, that's part of the problem with property dualism. So maybe we should look at things more substantially, if you'll pardon me for saying so. And that would lead us to hylomorphic substance dualism and robust substance dualism. And in the hylomorphic category, we could start with Aristotelianism. So what did Aristotle say? Well, he said that the soul was the form of the body. And if we're talking about a substance, it's a hylomorphic substance. So forms don't exist apart from their embodiment. And every embodiment has form, and these are a fundamental unity, right? So there's no substance without both of these things being present, form and matter. But form doesn't exist independently of matter, so obviously there's no disembodied consciousness. Everything is tied to the material world in a fundamental way. So the soul is then not an immaterial entity of some sort. It does not exist apart from the body in a strict kind of Aristotelian picture of things. So, but obviously, if you are a Christian, that's going to be problematic because it, well, either is going to lead to a picture in which you have to put all your hope in the resurrection with a gappy sort of existence, or there just is no life after death and no prospect or hope for the future. But that's another discussion by itself. So maybe we should then move on to Thomistic substance dualism, which is Aristotelian in the background, but I know you have sympathies in this area, Mike. It say that the form itself is substantial and it can exist apart from the body, but it is somehow incomplete apart from the body. So there's something fundamentally lacking when the soul separates from the body in this picture of things. So, and then we would, in following Aristotle, as Thomas did, talk about rational souls, sensate souls, and nutritive or vegetative souls. Everything that's alive has a soul, but the souls have different characters such that human beings are rational animals in the Aristotelian picture and at the Thomistic picture. But we have, in Thomas's understanding, a substantial form, a rational soul that can exist apart from the body, but is diminished by death and separation from the body and is in a reduced capacity state in which it has a rational existence, but presumably it would seem no sensory input or anything else until it is reunited with the body and the sensory components of that. So does that sound accurate to you?
Yes. Yes, definitely. I think so. It's a very nice synopsis of I think St. Thomas's view.
Okay. So one of the concerns here, and this also comes about with a form of composite robust dualism, is the question of what the thinking subject actually is.
Right.
If we've got a deep sort of hylomorphic unity of body and soul, it seems like we may have two thinking subjects,
right?
The rational soul and the hylomorphic composite, or in the case of robust dualism, the union of a body and soul. And that seems problematic. I don't think it's the intention of either Thomistic dualism or a composite robust dualism to say that there are two subjects with every act of thought, namely the soul and the soul-body composite.
Right.
So that's a bit of a concern there. It seems like a metaphysical inadequacy or problem with the position. And the other thing that would concern me about hylomorphic dualism in particular is the idea that the soul, once it departs from the physical body or is decoupled from the brain, if you like, is in a diminished state of some sort. And the reason I say that that's problematic is that the evidence from near-death experiences, at least if you take that evidence seriously, and I think there are many reasons to take it seriously, seems to indicate that rather than being in a diminished state, it is actually in a restorative and enhanced state in some respects. So in terms of being able to explain the nature of near-death experiences and what those who have been declared clinically dead and come back and reported on being revived would say is the nature of that experience, it seems like the Thomistic account of a diminished state of consciousness apart from the body is not the case. And so there is, if you like, a kind of empirical dissonance that comes about through a consideration of near-death experiences where hylomorphic dualism is concerned.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful summary of what I think is one of the fundamental weaknesses of Thomistic dualism, is its inability, or two weaknesses. One, its inability to come to grips with the what appears to be the unity of the human person. It does seem as though you're a form and a matter. But I don't feel like I'm two different things that are melded together. And I think the near-death experiences are a very powerful piece of evidence that favors a more robust substance dualism. So I think that you really hit the target there. There, you know, and a Thomistic dualist might argue that hylomorphic dualism is not a substance dualism, and that there is a unity. There's a single existing thing, which is a human being, and the form and matter of the human being are principles of the human being. You know, a principle of individuation for matter and a principle of intelligibility for form. But that's kind of a circumlocution, perhaps.
Yeah, and it's difficult to see how then one gets from abstract principles to, particularly in the case of disembodied existence, if you think that there's an intermediate state, a conscious person that survives the dissolution of that unity.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, yeah. There's a bit of hand waving that goes on to explain the subsistence of the soul from the hylomorphic perspective. Something that always kind of interests me is that Wilder Penfield, who is a neurosurgeon who studied epilepsy back in the mid 20th century, and did a lot of brain operations on people who were awake during the brain operations, and he stimulated the surface of their brain and recorded their experiences and so on. He did marvelous research on that. And he persistently found what he called the mind as something that was not a part of the brain that was unitary, that could not be stimulated. You couldn't evoke it. It was just there. And it seemed to be kind of the person himself that watched and observed and used the various powers of the brain. But he said it was not a physical thing, but it was very real, and he called it the mind. And I think he's quite right about that, and it's a little difficult to fit that into a purely hylomorphic way of understanding the human person.
Yeah, at the very least, it seems suggestive of a kind of substance dualism, or right. I think that those sorts of things are certainly able to be accommodated within an ontic idealism as well.
Sure, sure, absolutely. The one thing that really has led me to Thomistic dualism, besides just my general admiration for the whole Thomistic system, which I think it's a very beautiful and compelling system. It may not be exactly correct, but it sure is nice. But one thing that has led me to it is that there does seem to be in the human human mind a rather clear distinction between abstract thought and concrete thought. For example, between perception and abstract understanding, or between a sensitive appetite, you know, having a feeling of hunger and so on, and a will, which is kind of an abstract desiring something that isn't itself a sensitive appetite. There's this division between physical and between material and non-material. That idealism doesn't seem to naturally account for, whereas the hylomorphic view kind of naturally accounts for that for that finding in neuroscience. Any thoughts about that?
Well, I would say that there is kind of a form-matter distinction that is present in experience that is perfectly accommodatable within an idealist view of mind, where the formal things are abstractions from the sensory things, but all of these things have a basis in not in material reality. So the sensory experience, those are kinds of ideas that are, from a neurophenomenological perspective within idealism, experienced through the body, at least in the embodied state. And we have sensory perceptions in that respect. And that would be the kind of material component to things, the idea of the material world. But we can, of course, abstract from the material world and consider things geometrically. We can extract concepts of the will in response to the more visceral sensory ideas associated with that, with bodily desires and so on and so forth. So yeah, we can make a distinction between abstraction and concrete experience within an idealistic context that is, if you like, isomorphic to the one that the Thomistic dualist would be talking about. So it's just a shift in perspective, but I think you've still got abstraction and concreteness, if you want to put it that way, as a distinction between the form, the more formal aspects of experience, and the more concrete or material aspects of experience.
But one could say, if one were a bit of a skeptic on this, to say that, well, you can impose on idealism kind of a hylomorphic structure, mm-hmm. but then why not just embrace hylomorphism?
Well, in a way, you have, except the material is not substantially material, it's phenomenologically so, mm-hmm. if that makes,
sure.
if you're tracking
right.
with me there. So material world is phenomenological, mm-hmm. And one can abstract from the phenomenology of experience the forms in which that experience is presented.
So this is a really deep question, a sort of kind of like my 4-year-old daughter's question one time when she asked me who made God, and I just didn't know where to start with that one. And my question would be, if idealism is true, and one might say that we exist as thoughts in the mind of God, which I think is a pretty standard idealistic way of understanding reality, then what is our phenomenological concrete perception? What is matter, and why is it there? That is, why isn't our existence entirely just abstract thought? You know, why is matter brought into reality if all of reality really is only mental and we are thoughts in God's mind? Why bother with matter?
Well, I wouldn't say that we are merely thoughts in God's mind. I would say that our experience of the world is a form of divine communication to us, such that we are experiencing the world in God as ideas communicated to us. But we ourselves are immaterial substantial souls, or minds, if you prefer. We are not mere thoughts in God's mind. God actually brought into being spiritual substances. And this is a Berkeleyan view, as opposed to, say, the sort of idealism that would be advocated by Jonathan Edwards, in which it is much closer to what you're saying, that we too are just a thought in the mind of God, which would make us non-substantial beings. We too would just be ideas in the mind of a substantial being, namely God himself. But no, I'm saying that we are substantial beings, immaterial minds or souls brought into existence by God, who experience the world in God as an idea that he gives us that is, of course, intersubjectively coordinated with other people so that we are living in the same reality. And as far as why is there a material world is concerned, I would say that it is arguably a necessary basis for the experience as a finite being, that it is not a view from nowhere, it has to be a view from somewhere. And the material world is God's way of providing us an orientation to a location in time and space in which we can bring order to our experience and relate to each other. And so as if you look at it in terms of relational metaphysic and being related to God as structuring our world and related to each other in the world that God has made, I think the phenomena of the material world are God's way of achieving that, and something like that would be necessary for finite beings in order to be able to have experience. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It's kind of a beautiful, fascinating way of looking at it. I do note that there is a very strong flavor in that explanation that matter is a principle of individuation, which kind of brings us back to hylomorphism. It kind of seems that yes, that all of the deep insights of mm-hmm. idealism have this flavor of hylomorphism.
So. Sure, and I think it's entirely possible, and I'm quite amenable to appropriating, if you like, the tools of hylomorphism in articulating an idealist metaphysic.
Sure. And it's almost as if, and I've kind of thought this in a very funny way occasionally, that idealism is true, but the structure of the mind is hylomorphic. And it kind of blends the two of them.
Sure. The hylomorphic picture gives us a way of relating the concrete and the abstract in our experience and in our thought that is appropriatable within the context of idealism, or it could have been reflective of a more substantial notion of form-matter union rather than a mental form-matter union within a spiritual substance. But the relative merits then of those two pictures have to be discussed, which is part of what we're doing.
Sure. I think we should wrap up this session. So this is Mike Eggner. I have had the pleasure and privilege of speaking with my friend Bruce Gordon on dualism and on the philosophical problems associated with it, and on idealism and how one can fit the real world into an idealist perspective. So thank you, Bruce, and thank you all for listening.
This has been Mind Matters News. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters News is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters News is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.